I don't know all of you, of course. Because of the nature of this subject, I want you to know, as the kids say, where I'm coming from going in, okay? Because many of you don't know me. I'm a preacher. I've preached for 17 years, and I'm a Bible college professor. I did my undergraduate and master's work in Bible and theology and languages. And I took my doctorate from Miami of Ohio some years ago in the field of ancient history and physical anthropology. The way it works, I studied human evolution under the chairman in private studies under the chairman of the anthropology department. So that's my particular field of studying evolution. And I was examined in it. And we're going to have one session just on the story of human evolution. And so I have, as it were, sat on both sides of the table. The man I studied anthropology under was, as I say, was a convinced evolutionist, of course, and I had atheists and agnostics, you name it, sitting on my committee. So I come to you sort of as from both directions, from the field of Bible studies and theology as well as secular work, university work. And I am a creationist. I am not an evolutionist. I consider the first chapters of Genesis to be history. They are not poetry. They're not written the way the ancient Near Eastern people wrote poetry. It is not mythology. I do not claim to understand all that the early chapters of Genesis teach. I have about as many questions as I have answers. It's one thing to say that you consider it to be history. It's something else to be completely, in every detail, sure about what it teaches. But I'm a creationist, and I do everything I can to fight the theory of evolution, because the theory of evolution is not, as you will see in my view, is not a science, it's a philosophy. And it is I will demonstrate that, I think, and it is a very dangerous philosophy. It is antithetical to Christianity. And so that's my concern, the subject. I'm not trying to blow my own horn. I don't mean to do that at all. I just want, especially the kids here, I want you to know who's talking to you. I always like to know who's talking to me and where they're coming from. Now, I would like to begin by sharing something I didn't write. I wish I had. The world is full of stuff that I wish I'd written. You ever hear somebody say something, you say, "I wish I'd said that"? Well, I have a colleague down at Central Florida Bible College, a man called Michael Chambers, who is not related to me. It's a real coincidence. We have two men of the same family name on such a small faculty. But he was lecturing at the Florida State Convention last year. He was assigned the title "Evolution in Historical Perspective," and he wrote this as introduction. I told him I was going to steal it. I steal everything I can. And this is how he began his discussion on evolution in historical perspective, and it's very accurate and very graphic, and I begin with it. In William Faulkner's story, "As I Lay Dying," the surviving family members of a deceased mother carry her body in a wooden coffin for days in the back of a horse-drawn wagon to bury her in a certain town because of a pledge her husband has made to himself. This man promised himself he would bury his wife in a certain place. The reader experiences a growing horror at the inevitable decay of the body in the coffin as the pitiful company struggles across the hot, muggy southern countryside. As the story nears its conclusion, the stench becomes unbearable to the family. Vultures shadow their progress. The travelers begin to argue among themselves about their sorry situation. The readers feel outrage at the husband for insisting that the journey continue. The whole thing is, of course, unreasonable. Nevertheless, the husband, in a somewhat demented state, presses on for purely personal reasons. His has become a private universe in which other facts are irrelevant. This story furnishes a parable for the present state of atheistic, naturalistic, evolutionary thought. It is dead. It's been dead for some time. That fact notwithstanding, its caretakers persist in hauling the carcass about. Family members have begun to argue among themselves. We're going to come to that. Family members have begun to argue among themselves about the degenerating condition of the deceased. Some have declared their intent to bail out, but the decision to begin the journey has a certain momentum. Commitments have been made. Reputations are at stake. and those in the driver's seat press on for personal reasons not always apparent to those of us who observe the spectacle of the passing wagon load. His theme was, the lady's dead and she ought to be buried, but she won't be. And because the lady, even though she's dead, will not be buried, not in our lifetime, it's important that we do things like we're doing this weekend to talk about the subject of evolution. Now, the next thing I would say to begin is this, that it is not true that evolutionists are monsters. It is not true that they are dishonest. They do not have fangs that drool. They do not drool down the tie. Often they are pictured by creationists who ought to know better as being fundamentally outlaws, intellectual outlaws, and they are not. Evolutionists are guilty of many of the very things that Christians down through the years have been guilty of. They are the evolutionists in the main, the run-of-the-mill evolutionists, and those I work with at the university certainly fell into this classification, in my opinion, are victims. They are prisoners of a philosophy that is so all-embracing that there just isn't any way hard to get out of it. And I would say that evolution is not silly. Evolution is exceedingly convincing. A great deal of work has gone into it by a lot of people. I would go so far as to say that if someone begins to study evolution from the inside of the system, stays inside it, in all of his or her studies, they will become utterly convinced, because it is utterly convincing as long as you stay on the inside of it and study it. So evolutionists are not evil people, they're not stupid people, and they're not silly people, and they're not dishonest people. They are, in the main, people just about like we are. Now, So I'm going to say that going in. I want you to remember that. I may remind you of that. The evolutionist under which I studied, Dr. Jansen, I went in and I told him I was not an evolutionist. I'd studied it for some years from different angles, but I wanted to make sure I understood the system, and he said, that's fair enough. And I did the reading, and he asked me the questions, and I asked him a few, and he treated me as a gentleman and sat on my committee, and I had the highest respect for him. He's a fine gentleman. I think he's utterly wrong about his worldview. So evolutionists are not, in the main, as a class, any less reputable than Christians are as a class. Now, let me read you one more statement, which is going to startle you, I think, and was for to give a tone to the state of the question, and then I'll begin to systematically talk about it. And by the way, I have not capsulized all of the discussions I'm going to have this weekend, and so tonight we're just going to go until we get run out of time and then pick it up tomorrow. So we will not, I regret that, but it would be impossible to deal with everything I want to deal with in this one opening unit in the hour that we have. But I realize this is not going to be easy. I really appreciate your sticking with me. Let me read something to you, which is very interesting. This is the opening couple of paragraphs, about the same length as what I just read. This is a opening speech. This was delivered in 1981. This is recent, 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago, November, late 1981, by Dr. Colin Patterson. Now, Dr. Patterson is senior paleontologist and editor of the journal at the British Museum of Natural History in London. He is a paleontologist is one who puts dinosaur bones together, experts in ancient fossil evidence. Paleos is the Greek word for old or ancient. He is the leading paleontologist at the British Museum of Natural History in London. He's the editor of their journal, author of a book on evolution. He is one of the top five evolutionists in the world. By that I mean recognized as an expert. And he was asked to speak at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City at a gathering of evolutionists. And this is what he said. My title is Evolutionism and Creationism. I can tell you that title was laid on me by Don Rosen. I'm speaking on it to gratify this old friend of 700 years. It's being funny. I've never spoken on it before, and I hope never to have to speak on it again. It's true that for the last 18 months or so, I've been kicking around non-evolutionary and even anti-evolutionary ideas. I think always before in my life, when I've got up to speak on a subject, I've been confident of one thing, that I know more about it than anybody in the room, because I've worked on it. Well, this time it isn't true. I'm speaking on two subjects, evolutionism and creationism, and I believe it's true to say that I know nothing whatever about either of them. One of the reasons I started taking this anti-evolutionary view, or let's call it a non-evolutionary view, was last year I had a sudden realization that for over 20 years I had thought I was working on evolution in some way. One morning I woke up and something had happened in the night, and it struck me that I had been working on this stuff for 20 years and there was not one thing I knew about it. By that he means knew for sure. That's quite a shock to learn that one can be so misled so long. Either there was something wrong with me or there was something wrong with evolutionary theory. Naturally, I know there's nothing wrong with me. So for the last few weeks, I've tried putting a simple question to various people and groups of people. Question is, and these are among his colleagues mainly, can you tell me anything you know about evolution? Any one thing that is true? I tried that question on the geology staff at the Field Museum of Natural History, and the only answer I got was silence. I tried it on the members of the Evolutionary Morphology Seminar at the University of Chicago, a very, very prestigious body of evolutionists, and all I got there was silence for a long time, and eventually one person said, "I do know one thing, it ought not to be taught in high school." Now, if something like that can be said, and that kind of thing can go on, at the absolute top echelons of the evolutionary establishment, as you might call it, I suggest that the lady's dead. And it's about time to bury her. As I say, not that she will be buried. Now, what he just said, what could have been said by the most staunch creationist ever born. But it wasn't. Now, I want you tonight to begin to think with you through the general picture. I want to give you, before we talk about specifics in the issue of creation versus evolution, I want to give us the big picture. What creationism is and what it is not, what evolution is and what it is not. Now, first of all, I would like to say that creationism is not, when I say I'm a creationist and I treat the book of Genesis as sober history, as factual, propositional history, I am not subscribing to the old Leupold Usher view of creation at 9 o'clock in the morning, October 23rd, 4004 B.C. For a long time, that was considered to be the creationist view. And it was that way by some very ingenious hermeneutics, not the least of which was to treat the genealogies in Genesis 5 and Genesis 11, which talks about who begat who and how long they lived, as chronologies. By the way, if you just take that and add up the years, that meant that Adam would have known Noah's father, that Shem would have outlived Abraham, and that Methuselah would have had to swim through the flood. I mean, if you just took the Bible and added them up, so I do not believe the world was created in 4004 B.C. at 9 o'clock in the morning on October 23rd. Creationism is something this side of that. Now, as for evolution, it's always funny to me that the modern evolutionists, mainly humanists, those who are attached to the humanist movement, who want to poke fun at creationism, they like to go back to the famous Scopes monkey trial, which the evolutionists lost, by the way. And they make fun of William Jennings Bryan. They made a movie, Inherit the Wind. And they like to say things like, "Well, I thought all that was settled back then." And they laugh at the defense of the Bible that Clarence Darrow made. Well, if you want something, and it was a somewhat humorous, Clarence Darrow was not a Bible scholar, and his defense of the Bible was rather inadequate, naive. But if you really want to laugh, you ought to reread the version of evolution up against which he came. He was ridiculed for not accepting the unescapable evidence of the Nebraska man, which was a single tooth, which later turned out to be the tooth of an extinct pig. There was not a sober, enlightened evolutionist today who would defend any particular of the theory of evolution that was in the form in which it was delivered against William Jennings Bryan in the famous Scopes Monkey Trial. You know what I'm talking about, this Tennessee situation. So things have changed. And let me say this, and listen very closely to this. I'm going to give you, see, I come to this as from the area of theology and Bible studies and evolution itself, but also as history. I want you to know something, that we are in the infancy of this debate. I want us to give us a perspective. We are in the infancy from the biblical point of view. We are in the infancy from the scientific point of view. And, of course, I do not mean that this is a dichotomy. These are not opposite points of view. Let me take the scientific point of view first. Do you realize that the theory of evolution has changed about every 25 years, and that those who have put together the current, what I call the textbook version of the theory of evolution, those men, which is considered science by many, most of these men are still alive, still working. We are literally in almost the first generation of sober, genuinely scientific work on the theory of evolution. We're going to see as we go through this that most of the work that's been done on evolution has not been done by the science department. It's been done by the philosophy department and the social sciences. Evolution works better in those departments. It doesn't work very well in the science department. That's one of the reasons why men like Colin Patterson said what he said. He said, if you go and read the rest of the speech, he simply said, boys, I've tried it, and it doesn't work. Tried it mathematically. We'll talk about that in a minute. But so that it is rapidly changing. Understand? The theory of evolution, one of the things we're going to see is that the theory of evolution, which is taught, which is neo-Darwinism, we'll come back to that, which is the textbook evolution in grade schools and high schools and undergraduate schools and college and in some graduate departments, that version of evolution will be there for the next 20 years or so. It is absolutely not the version of evolution that exists in the upper echelons among what I call the godfathers of evolution. It is not believed by the leaders in the movement, not taught by them. It is simply delivered for classroom consumption. And by the time the classroom version catches up with the version that appears in the periodicals, the scientific periodicals, they will have changed too. Take my word for it. It's very foolish for a Christian today. I call it the now we know syndrome. Well, we don't have to believe the Bible anymore. Well, you see, now we know. We know how change takes place. We know how things evolve. Oh, do we know? But what we now know is not what we knew in 1940 or 1920. Oh, yes, but now we know. You can be assured that now we know. Well, don't tell a historian that. A historian tends to say, oh, let's just wait and see. Very foolish for a Christian today to throw away his faith on the basis of what, quote, now we know. We always kid the liberals about theology on the wing. Evolution is science on the wing, and very few can catch up with it. And so we're in the infancy of this. You understand? In other words, the basic theories, and from the scientists now, are being worked out by men who are still alive and still working, most of them. Some of the men who did the basic scientific work have died, but not some of them are still alive. And from a historical perspective, that's just like being in the kindergarten stage. The second thing I would say is that, considering the interpretation of Genesis, we are in the infancy of biblical interpretation in some areas. Do you realize that the main contribution of archaeology to the Bible is not apologetics, not Christian evidences, but in hermeneutics, to understand the nature of these ancient documents written back in the 14th century, referring to a time back in the 18th and 19th centuries B.C., the patriarchal age. And there has come to light, since the turn of this century, thousands and thousands of cuneiform tablets, contemporary literature, which gives us a feel for and what I'm saying is, don't tune me out on this, is that one of the things that is coming to light is that we are learning that the connection between thoughts and words, how thoughts or ideas are expressed in words, is not uniform. And that the connection between realities and the words that are written down to express those realities are somewhat different from the way we use language. What I'm saying is it's very foolish for anybody to look at the Old Testament and in every case say, well, now, this is what it would mean if I had written these words. That is therefore the force of this language. And do you realize that the pioneers in the field of archaeology, most of them, were alive 15 years ago? Those who made archaeology a science, most of them were alive 15 years ago. Do you realize the greatest field of archaeological endeavor today is the basement of the British Museum? We have over 250,000 clay tablets that have never even been translated, already available, and more coming in all the time. And what I'm saying is that from both the scientific viewpoint and from the hermeneutical viewpoint, that is, hermeneutics being the science of interpreting the Bible, we are in the infancy of that in regard to certain aspects. Now, the New Testament is not so true because we've had the classical materials to compare the New Testament literary style with for that's never been lost. But the Old Testament material, and so that while what I'm trying to say and not saying it very well is this, that we ought to, what we're going to talk about this weekend is the stage of the question. And one of the things we're going to see is that the Bible is gaining ground in this debate already. But that's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is, I think we ought to be very slow. I think the evolutionists, and they're learning this the hard way, they've learned it the hard way, that they ought to be very slow to draw their ironclad conclusions and say, well, we can forget the Bible, that we can forget Genesis because now we know. They're learning better. Like Patterson. What he did couldn't have happened in 1960. And he's not alone. Do you realize that there are, let me finish my thought. So that we, and so when I say I treat the Bible as history, Genesis as history, as sober history, as propositional history, and I'm a confirmed creationist, I think there are many questions in connection with the interpretation of Genesis that are, which are not central questions, but which are, which I think we might say, well, it might mean this, and it might be this, because the Genesis account of creation, in case you haven't noticed, is very brief. Read it sometime. It won't take you long. It doesn't tell us very much. And so we stand firm on the proposition that God created man from nothing, and that I utterly reject, when I say evolution, now we're going to see that I'm going to say two things this weekend about evolution. We'll say evolution is true, and evolution is false. What is false is total chance organic monophyletic. I'm going to tell you what this means, man. Monophyletic mega evolution. This is what is claimed in textbook evolution. You got that? This is what is claimed. This is not what is proved. Total means that everything, the whole biological order, plants and animals, including man, all of it came by purely natural processes. Natural processes tell the whole story. It's total. You don't have part of the created order, part of the biological order. Biological means living things. Part of the biological order evolving and part of it being created. It's total evolution. Chance means there's no direction from God or anybody else. Pure chance just happened. In other words, we just happen to be here. Organic refers to living things. Monophyletic means of one phyla, meaning coming from one source, this initial beginning of life. Mega evolution means evolution that takes the process from one kind or one species, which is a very arbitrary term, to another species. Now I explain the difference between mega evolution and microevolution later. But that's what we're talking about. And this is what's in the textbooks. Total chance, organic, monophyletic, mega-evolution. That is what is false. Now, I say that because the old creationist view of Leupold Usher that put the creation at 4004 B.C. also said that God created every single species and every single subspecies in exactly the form that we know them, and there has been no change since creation. And that's very silly. All you have to do is be a farmer, and you'll know better than that. You can look at the capacity of basic kinds of animals to differentiate. Variety within kinds or phyla or species, depending on which term you want to use, are ever before us. But obviously, God did not create every kind of dog, every kind of canine, just as it is, and there's been no change since creation. Creationists are often accused of defending that. I know of very few creationists who are defending that. And that is not, but we're talking about mega evolution. Okay, now, we're going to look now at sort of the history of the development of the theory of evolution, which I think will be instructive for us. And now, this may be boring. I'll try to move as quickly as I can. The theory of evolution was around long before Darwin, of course. The ancient Greeks had theories of evolution. But Erasmus, I want to say, and listen to me, you young people, listen to this. If you listen to Carl Sagan with his series, what's his life on Earth? That's not his series. What's The Cosmos. Carl Sagan is a humongous liar. He's too good a scholar not to be a liar. I don't mean to be unkind. Maybe the Lord forgive me for that. But he's too good a scholar to know. He's too good a scholar not to know that many of the things he's saying are simply not true. You're not getting science with Carl Sagan. You're getting propaganda. And listen, that is not the creationist point of view. That's the evolutionist point of view as well. One of the things that Carl Sagan says, and I've heard him say it, is he gives this long lecture on, and this is what he says. He says that the medieval church squelched all scientific inquiry. Galileo and Copernicus and the Renaissance men, who were the sort of the proto-scientists, the ones who were sort of opened the Western world to science, that these men began the process, and that religion, historical Christianity, has always squelched the march of science, and that science has made progress only to the extent that men have divorced themselves from a biblical point of view or from a creationist position. That is absolutely false. It is historically false. The modern science as a discipline was developed by believers, not unbelievers. The basic assumption was, since there is a God, and he is an intelligent God, and this is his creation, there must be an order to it, and by looking at it, we can discover that order. And you just read the history. I don't have time to go into this. But that was the impetus. It was from a theistic emphasis. You got that? It was not from a, that is, believers in the Word of God are the fathers of modern science. It's simply a matter of history. And I won't go into that. On the other hand, and this is not a matter of controversy, this is a matter of historical fact, that evolution, the theory of evolution, the driving force, the impetus, the energy, which has moved it forward from the middle of the 19th century till today, is not a scientific impetus, it is a philosophical impetus. It has not been pushed, follow me? The driving, the thing that has pushed it forward to overcome all odds and to be accepted despite all obstacles, this driving force is philosophical, not scientific. Now, that's just circumstantial evidence, but that's history. And Carl Sagan, in his presentation, which high school kids are encouraged to watch sometimes, he reverses that. And what he says is simply not true. You know, I'm convinced he knows better. For instance, you go back, give an example. Even back Pasteur and all these men were believers in the Word of God, believers in the Bible. The British societies that financed scientific endeavor in the late 19th century had over 90% of their members were confessed Christians. The idea that the humanists gave us science And the Christians gave us ignorance. It's utterly false. It's the opposite of the truth. I had a discussion once with, I was telling Art about it. I had a debate in Orlando last year between the before the Religion and Philosophy Club at Rollins College, and I met in an informal debate, open discussion, two men, Jim Hooper, the president of the American Civil Liberties Union in Florida, and a man called Dr. Edwin Wilson. Dr. Edwin Wilson is probably the most, as far as damaging American society, is the most dangerous man we've had who's alive today. He is one of the founding fathers of the American Humanist Association. He is the primary author of Humanist Manifesto 1 and Humanist Manifesto 2. And we were having this discussion, and he pulled that. He pulled this thing that Sagan pulls, that secular humanism gives you science and Christianity gives you ignorance. And I stopped him and pointed out that wasn't true. And I said, now, if you want to look at the history books, if you want to look what secular humanism gave us, secular humanism gave us the French Revolution, the destruction of society in northern Italy, and syphilis. The secular humanism did not give us science. Christianity gave us science. Are you kidding? That's simple. You understand? That's simply history. It's not speculation. You kids hear that? You don't listen to what anybody else says. You can just check the books on that one. Well, anyway, Erasmus Darwin, who was Charles Darwin's grandfather, coined the term evolution. But it was a philosophy. You see, there's a saying in philosophy. It goes like this. There aren't very many men in the room. Now, what a philosopher means when he says that is, there are only so many possibilities. There are only so many explanations. Now, there's only so many explanations for our presence. You can take there are only about three explanations. You take the Buddhist explanation that says we aren't really here. And that's not all that helpful, because even though we might not really be here for the time being, it doesn't really work. I didn't pay my taxes. I wrote the IRS, I've become a Buddhist and I'm not here, and therefore I can't pay taxes. Then there is the creationist view, not necessarily biblical creationist, but if we're here, we must have been put here. A creationist view. Or there is an evolutionary view which says that we are here by, in other words, the creationist view, whether it's Bible creationist or not, simply says that we have a supernatural origin, or there is the view that we have a natural origin. Now, not many, those who believe we have a purely natural origin, we're here by pure chance, not many of them hold that we just popped into existence. All these molecules were shuffling around the universe, and by pure chance, all of a sudden you got higher forms of life reproducing itself, reacting to stimuli, and functioning biologically. Nobody says that. So, you see, there aren't many men in the room. If you're not a Buddhist, you either got to be a creationist or an evolutionist. There are no alternatives. And for that reason, you had men like Erasmus Darwin, who was Charles Darwin's grandfather, who was pushing evolution, but it had no scientific base, whatever. In other words, the argument went like this, and I'm not oversimplifying. This is exactly the argument. They say, well, now, we can either accept creationism, and that gives us, if you got creationism, you got a creator. We don't want a creator. Why? Because that means God, or a God, and that means if he created us, we're responsible to him. He might have something to say about how we live. Therefore, we don't have a supernatural origin. We have a natural origin. That's therefore we must have evolved. As a purely, when the word evolution was coined, it was a purely philosophical assertion. Why? Well, you aren't that many men in the room. Since we know creation didn't happen, we must have evolved. There's one of the dictums of evolution still being used. Well, a lot of problems with evolution. Out of my profession, I went around on this. Well, but it must have happened. Why? Well, here we are. And if we're here, we must have evolved. Now, well, which is you follow me? It's a philosophical position, not a scientific position. Now, a man called Chevalier de Lamarck, 1744 to 1829, if you're interested, he tried to give this philosophy a scientific basis. This was a scientific age dawning. It's good to be scientific. Lamarck, he thought, well, now, how did we evolve? We know we evolved. Why? Well, we just know that. How did we evolve? Lamarck said we evolved, and he, this way, and he cooked up, and it was illogical, he couldn't investigate it, the theory of the transmission of acquired characteristics. He said, here's how we change. That the environment changes, and that whenever the environment changes, why, there's little things in our body. He called it vital fluids. And these vital fluids tell the members of our body that we need to change because the food's getting scarce or the weather's getting cold. And so this animal or this creature will change. And then he will pass that change on to his offspring. He liked the example of the giraffe. How did the giraffe get a long neck? Well, first of all, it needed it. It's one of the laws of evolution that a need is a sufficient cause. How did it get there? Well, it needed it. And so, because they had a drought and the only food to eat was up on the higher limbs, and so what happened was that these giraffes would stretch their necks. According to Lamarck, stretch and stretch and stretch. And did you ever see that some of these African tribes where they would put braces on the people's necks and stretch them through their whole life? Well, that's kind of happened to the giraffe, only they did it themselves. They get this long neck. And then, of course, these vital fluids in their body programmed that into their reproductive system so that when they had offspring, their offspring had longer necks. The transmission of a family, they acquired this characteristic. And then they passed this characteristic on to their offspring. Sounded very logical. It doesn't work. My mother was scared by a bear when she was carrying me, and I was born barefooted. But it's just about as logical. And you know, if you stay out in the sun, your baby will be born with dark skin because you'll acquire this characteristic, and they'll pass it on. Well, now of course it didn't work. It doesn't work that way. It's not true. You can sit in the sun and cook yourself brown, and your baby will be born with no darker skin than if you never saw the sun. What your children are going to be is genetically programmed the moment you're conceived. And unless there's a breakdown through radiation or something, that's what it's going to be. It's genetic. Well, anyway, so for a while, Lamarckianism, the transmission of acquired characteristics, became the scientific base. But it wasn't not very satisfactory because you couldn't look at it and see it. You could take mice and cut off their tails every generation for generation to generation, and they would not have tailless babies. You cannot pass on acquired characteristics. Now, a man called Geoffrey St. Hilaire came along, and he suggested that something else caused it. There were deviant forms. He laid the ground for what came to be called natural selection. But the person who really got the theory going was not a scientist again. It was not a physical scientist, but a social scientist named Malthus, who lived at the turn of the 19th century. He wrote a book called Essay on Population, in which here's what he said: that populations on the earth, or even among animals, grows until you get too many people and they run out of food. Then you got too many people and not enough food, and then there's a struggle for the food. And in this struggle, you've got starvation, disease, and war. They'll fight each other. They'll get sick. And only the strongest will survive in this struggle for food. He called it struggle for existence. Another social scientist, not a physical scientist, a social scientist called Herbert Spencer, he liked that idea. And he expanded on it, and he coined the phrase survival of the fittest. It did not come from Charles Darwin. It came from Herbert Spencer. And this became the idea that society evolved, the evolution of society. And by the way, the theory of evolution has dominated from Malthus and Herbert Spencer on. It has dominated the social scientists. I'm sorry, the social sciences. Still has. It's interesting, it was accepted by the social scientists at a time when it was not accepted by the physical scientists. It's interesting, you went from the philosophy department
dabbled its toes in science with Lamarck, immediately went to work in the social sciences and been there ever since. It's interesting, the social sciences today, modern, secular, the social sciences which dominate most of our educational process, the theories are based upon a pseudo-scientific, it is based upon a theory of evolution that has never been accepted in the area of the physical sciences. You got that? It made a good social science, wasn't a good physical science. It never has been. It's very alarming, isn't it? Then came Darwin, and Darwin's contribution was this, and by the way, I think you should know that nothing, the latest thought is, by Patterson and many, and by even those who are confirmed evolutionists, listen to me, the latest conclusion is this, that concerning mega evolution, which is what you have to have to get one species out of another species, one kind out of another kind, that Darwin said absolutely nothing about mega evolution. He wrote a book called Origin of Species, and he didn't say anything about origins, didn't say anything about species. Other than that, it's a pretty good book. Darwin's Origin of Species, by the way, that is where it stands now. Darwin is dead. His name is waved like a flag over the field of battle between evolution and creationism, but Darwin is, he's not dead among the creationists, he's dead among the evolutionists. It's determined that he said not one thing about real evolution. Origin of Species has now taken its place with Christian Science. He said nothing about origin nor species with Christian Science, which is neither Christian nor science, and Grape Nuts, cereal, which is neither grapes nor nuts. But what Darwin did was, he took this philosophy, which was already doing business, this theory, which was already doing business in the philosophy department, and was doing big business in the social science. Now, they didn't call it social sciences back then. It was that area which became what we now call social sciences. He finally came along and gave it what seemed to be a scientific base. After it was already a working philosophy, already a working social science, then he came along and was going to give it, to make it a science. And he traveled to the Galapagos Islands off Ecuador, and he saw forms of plants and animals, mainly and certain birds, that were peculiar to that area. And here's what he said. He said that this is how evolution takes place. Animals in particular, they become isolated geographically by immigration. Birds fly to an island and then have offspring. And once they're cut off from the general population, then nature selects certain kinds because only certain kinds can survive. And this natural selection produces new species. Now that seemed to be a scientific explanation for evolution. We now know that it isn't. But it seemed to be. You got that? And all of a sudden, this is why evolution exploded with Darwin. Finally, you understand? Finally, this philosophy had been given what seemed to be a scientific base. And it went like crazy. It was a literally an intellectual revolution. All of a sudden, everything had to be explained in terms of evolution. The place that it went the slowest, and again, it really got moving. It got moving, in the philosophy department, which I was already using it, they went with it. The social sciences went crazy. They fell all over themselves. The only area that it went real slow was in the area of the physical sciences again, because they began to notice that Darwin had said much about at least ostensibly, about the survival of the fittest, had said nothing about the arrival of the fittest. All he had talked about was why certain animals in a certain environment or certain plants live when others don't live. In other words, they live and then reproduce. He had not said one thing about how they got there in the first place. It was pointed out that he hadn't. And so In the science department, I don't know if you can get this, in the science department, interesting, in philosophy, it was Darwin. In the social sciences, it was Darwin. Even in history, it was Darwin. The old JEDP, Critical View of the Old Testament, was Darwinian. The evolution of the patriarchal narratives, talk about. It was Darwin everywhere except in the science department, and there they realized that it was totally inadequate, and so they said, yes, evolution, yeah, now we have evolution, now it's a science, but the mechanism that they used was Lamarck. They went back to Lamarck because Darwin hadn't said anything about how different animals arrive. And so you have Darwinism, philosophy, Darwinism, social science, Lamarckianism, among the physical sciences as they were developing. Now, influence, Darwin tried to figure out how these new species really came. He worked up the theory that different parts of the body sent out little particles in the blood as messengers, and the blood carried these little messengers down to the gonads, or the reproductive organs, and then told them what changes were needed to be made based upon this changing environment. And he tried to, and so that the offspring would be modified. A fellow called Francis Galton put Darwin's theory of change, which was very close to Lamarck, he put it to a test. What he did was he took rabbits, male rabbits and female rabbits, and he took the blood from the male rabbits, which were of one color, and he injected this blood, which was supposed to contain the messengers of that color, into the blood of a female rabbit of another color on the theory that their offspring would be something in the middle. You know with me? You take a black rabbit, the blood from a black rabbit, and inject it into a white rabbit and get a gray rabbit. According to Darwin's theory of change, that's the way it should have worked. Of course, it didn't work. You can't do it that way. It doesn't work. And so it didn't work. And then, evolution as a science, as a physical science, was bogged down again. Are you all interested in this? I don't hope I'm not boring you. Are you tired? Can you go a few more minutes? Let me complete this cycle. Okay. Now, then came along a man who rescued Darwin, a man called Gregor Mendel. He was the father of the science of genetics. Now, Gregor Mendel was the first one to suggest a mechanism for the arrival of the fittest. That's what they really need. Follow me. Darwin said how they survived. We needed Mendel to tell how they arrived. At least ostensibly. By the way, he had published his work in 1865. Darwin published Origin of Species in 1859, 6 years before this. But nobody noticed Mendel's work. He was a botanist, and he used garden peas because they have several different characteristics and they multiply. You don't have to wait a long time to get different crops. You can get generations rapidly. And began to stumble on what we now know as the science of genetics, change. He noticed that you could predict change. You could make certain plants with certain some plant peas had the pods on top. Some of them had them down the vine. Some the pod was crinkly. Some it was smooth. Some had large peas in them. Some had small peas. Some of the plants were tall. Some of the plants were small. And by keeping careful records and cross-pollinating these, you could predict change. As you would know that you could predict in a certain percentage, certain characteristics would show up, like the smooth skin or the tall size, and in a certain number, they would not show up within a range, not exact number, within a range. So it was predictable. Now his work was, Mendel's work was popularized when a man called Hugo de Vries, Hugo D-E, small d-e, V-R-I-E-S, 1848 to 1935, he picked up and he reproduced what Mendel had done. He really popularized and expanded the work of Mendel. He coined the word mutation, which is from a Latin word which means to change. Changes within plant life as he was investigating it. And then this led to the work of another man called Thomas Hunt Morgan, who died in 1945. Now, see how recent this is? Morgan died in 1945. He's the one who began the work on the famous fruit fly, Drosophila melanogaster, the fruit fly, the long-suffering fruit fly. Now, fruit flies, they needed something that were not plants in the animal kingdom, insect in this case. And fruit flies, they use those because they're easily to, they live well, they're easy to work with, and they reproduce, they go through generations rapidly. You don't have to wait forever to get offspring. And they did everything, these poor fruit flies. Mainly, they have brought about mutations through X-rays, bombarding their genetic system with X-rays, causing mutations. And then they would take these new fruit flies and put them in various environments, and lo and behold, they thought they were onto something. That this was how the species arrived, through this mutation, although very little was understood about it. But they made a very sad discovery. Just about the time they got in high gear, they found out something. That natural selection stopped evolution. That is, they would mutate these little boogers, and everywhere, and they got fruit flies with all different colored eyes, fruit flies without eyes, fruit flies with wings that wouldn't fly, fruit flies with no wings, crippled fruit flies, homosexual fruit flies. You name it, they had different fruit flies. And lo and behold, they found that if they let these mutated fruit flies compete in the environment, that nature always selected back for the good old-fashioned fruit fly. And all the changes died out. That is, natural selection went the wrong way. Well, it was back to go. They did not pass. They went directly to jail. They did not collect $100. They're right back where they started. The whole thing died as a science. The period between 1900 and 1925 was called the agnostic period by evolutionists themselves. They just figured that it wasn't going to work. Let me step over here and get the book. One of the leading evolutionists at this time is a man called Bateson. And Bateson said this in this agnostic period. I may seem behind the times in asking. Now, I'm going to read this to you, but don't do a lot of this. I want you to see the philosophical nature of this. You understand? Scientifically, it had run up against a brick wall. It stopped. Nothing was working. It was going strong in the philosophy still, in the social sciences. I may seem behind the times. He wrote, by the way, he said this in a speech given in 1921 before the American Association for the Advancement of Science. I may seem behind the times in asking you to devote an hour to an old topic of evolution. Discussions of evolution came to an end primarily because it was obvious that no progress was being made. When students of other sciences ask us what is now currently believed about the origin of species, you got this? Students of the other sciences ask us what is now being believed about the origin of species, we have no clear answer to give. Faith has given place to agnosticism. We just thought, sure, the thing is going to work. We have absolute certainty that, listen to this, we have absolute certainty that new forms of life, new orders, and new species have arisen on Earth. That is proven by the paleontological record. He means fossils, which it wasn't. Our faith in evolution stands unshaken. Now, it was about this time that evolution began to become, to enter the classrooms. At a time during the agnostic period, during the William Jennings Bryan period, the Clarence Darrow period. Did you hear what he said? This is what he's saying. They've asked us how it works. What is the science? They were asking, okay, we got this thing going now. What is the scientific basis for it? His answer is, we have the foggiest notion. We do not know. But we are absolutely certain that it's true. Now, I grew up on a farm, and I know that the one thing you're not certain about is anything you don't know anything about. That's the one thing you're not certain about. But I want us to see that it was why were they certain? Basically because there are only so many men in the room. Here we are. We know that God didn't create us, therefore we must have evolved. We just don't know how. Now, our young people began to be told in America that intelligent people, scientifically minded people, no longer accept Genesis at a time when the scientists themselves were in an agnostic period. They said, we don't know. If it's a science, we can't figure out how it is. We know it works. We don't know how. Everything we've tried has failed. And they clung to their faith, had a pretty good time ridiculing the creationist, relying on the circumstantial evidence of the fossil record, which we're going to talk about this weekend, as the closest thing they could have, they could come to substantiating it. This brings us to the rise of neo-Darwinism. I'm going to go a while longer. I don't want to wear you out. Neo-Darwin, you can leave if you want to. I'll go a few more minutes, then we'll quit. I have some questions. This brings us to neo-Darwinism. Began with men like J.B.S. Haldane, R.A. Fisher, S. Wright, and S.S. Zverikov, his name, 1880, born 1880. But it was really synthesized, put together by a man called Dobzhansky, who in 1937, see how recent this is? In 1937, published a book called Genetics and the Origin of Species, 1937. He started what is called neo-Darwinism. Neo-Darwinism is what is the version which is in all the textbooks. Okay? Neo-Darwinism. Now, he was followed by J.S. Huxley, Edward Meyer, and George Gaillard Simpson, and G.L. Stebbins. These men, Dobzhansky, Huxley, Meyer, George Gaillard Simpson, I got a book of his here with me, and Stebbins are what I call the godfathers of evolution. The godfathers of neo-Darwinism. Now, here's what they said. What were they going to do in the light of the fact that they had no scientific base for it? Well, they said this. We're going to think about it this way. Even though we have learned in the laboratory with the fruit flies taught us that natural selection stops evolution. But here's how we're going to think about it. We're going to say that mutations furnish the raw material for evolution, tiny changes, and that natural selection weeds out and leaves the best changes. These changes are tiny changes, and the evolutionary pressures, the pressures of natural selection, are very slight pressures. So you get tiny changes. No one generation can see them. Imperceptible changes. It's called gradualism. An extremely gradual process. A tiny, tiny change. Slightly worked on by the environment, natural selection. But if you do this often enough, long enough, you've got evolution. And they constructed and continue to construct mathematical, listen to this, this is very important, you need to learn this. They constructed mathematical models to establish evolution. Theoretical mathematical models. The only proof that exists today for mega evolution, and by the way, this is not a creationist saying this, an evolutionist, if he knows what he's talking about, will admit this. The only evidence today, other than the fossil record, which we'll talk about, for mega evolution, are theoretical mathematical models. There is scientific evidence for what is called microevolution, variation within kind, within species. And so what they said was, and they thought up a law that was going to be the basic law of evolution. Are you with me? Tiny changes. They said it's true that all the fruit flies went the wrong way, but we've only been doing this for 30 or 40 years. If this process had gone on for 30 or 40 million years, we would have got evolution. So what they did was they took variation within species and they did what's called extrapolation. They extrapolated in these mathematical models. And here's the law, which they never put in the books, in these words, although I found a couple of books where it actually did appear, but they weren't reputable books. But this is the unwritten law of evolution. Are you ready? Given enough time, anything must happen. That is, they say, given enough time, that which is improbable becomes probable. And if you continue to give it time, that which is probable becomes certain. Now, if you just think about that logically, if you believe that, then that means that there's nothing that cannot exist. If time has been infinite, then everything must exist at least once. You can think about that tonight when you go home and go to bed. But now, that is not scientific. Extrapolate mathematical models, extrapolations from microevolution, which we're going to talk about, this is what's in the textbook. You got this? The gradual accumulation of changes over vast periods of time. And so they went on their way. I would simply point out that when they said this, they offered this to the public school children. This is textbook evolution. I studied it. But I want you to know something, that they don't believe it. There are today, as I suggested, two basic theories of evolution. And I'm going to just about to quit now. I hope I haven't. I've taken advantage of it. We got a lot to cover this weekend. There is the basic theory of evolution, general evolution, mega evolution. We're going to come back to these terms that appears in the textbooks. Then there is, and that is, it just seeps scientific certainty. It's offered as science. No real. There may be some doubt about particulars, but no doubt about the general thing. And the kids get the impression that, boy, these fellows have got this figured out. They're very certain about it. That's absolutely false. And here, the godfathers of evolution, I do not consider to be particularly honest. The crowd at the top. They have put stuff in textbooks for years that they knew was not true. Let me give you an example. I've just got a book here. You ready for this? Can you see this? I hope this isn't too worn out. Let me adjust it. Remember I gave you the name of G. Gaylord Simpson of Harvard? I'll just give one example of this, and we're not going to spend all the time on this. You ever see, if they want to show evolution, the textbooks, they always show the evolution of the horse. You ever seen that? The Eohippus, the Don Horse. The horse always gets in all the books. G. Gaylord Simpson, in his book, Life of the Past, 1953, said this. I'm reading this one. I'll read it for you in case you can't see it. He said this. Understand? He's one of the godfathers. The evolution of the horse family included, indeed, certain trends, but none of these was undeviating or orthogenic. What he's saying is not straight line evolution. This nice little neat package you get in the school books, you know, in the pictures, shows this little animal, like a hieraxis, Eohippus, and this goes up to the modern horse. The uniform, continuous transformation of Hierakotherium into Equus, this little animal into a horse, so dear to the hearts of generations of textbook writers, never happened in nature. What do you think about that? We're going to see when we... Now, my particular field, of course, is anthropology. We're going to talk about that in some detail. I want you to know something. I'm going to say it here. That the picture of anthropology, the scheme of anthropology that Carl Sagan delivers and appears in the Time Life series, for instance, is an absolute fraud. Not from the creationist point of view, but from the evolutionary anthropologist point of view. It's my professor one time at the university. I said to him, I said, Dr. Jansen, I said, you and I both know that none of you fellows believe what's in the Time Life series, that popular textbook picture of the evolution of man. He said, of course not. And I said, well, why don't you say something about it being the textbook? Well, he said, you got to put something in there. So there is not one, and I just give you that as an example. We're going to come back to some more things that Simpson said. And so when I say neo-Darwinism was accepted, it was accepted not really as a hard science. It was accepted as a, as an explanation you could hand to the public, and it would make sense, some kind of sense. By the way, if you read these mathematical models, they are very, very, very impressive, and they appear to be very scientific. We're going to talk about how this was challenged in the morning or tomorrow afternoon by the mathematicians. We're going to see the mathematicians said to the evolutionists, "Whoa, you better find out something about mathematical models before you go too far." That comes tomorrow. But why were they so anxious? Why would G. Gaylord Simpson say, well, now, we know all the textbook writers have been putting the horse in there, and we know it never happened in nature. But doesn't it look good in the textbook? Doesn't that look nice? Why were the godfathers of evolution, in my opinion, very cynically willing to allow public consumption, especially in our schools, of a theory that very few of them ever believed, an explanation that they could not really accept? Not really. The answer is that evolution had already taken over the philosophy department. As I've already said, it's taken over the social sciences. And for 40 years, it's been declared a proven scientific fact. And they were in the position where they had to say something. When neo-Darwinism became the explanation of evolution, it no longer is, by the way. It's gone now, except in the textbooks. When it became the explanation of evolution, it was after a period, this agnostic period. They've been whistling in the dark for between 19, well, at least for 25 of those years, 20 and 25, very clearly. They've been saying, oh, yes, the Bible's done for, no more Genesis, oh, yes, evolution. And people saying, oh, yes, interesting, explain it to me. Well, we're going to. We're just about ready to tell you how it's a science. It's just almost a science. We're just with it, and we're just on the verge. And they've been saying this for so long, finally they had something to say, and they said it wholesale. Not that they believed it. Some did, some didn't. But the fact that men like G. Gaylord Simpson from Harvard would like to, I think that's symbolic in a way, isn't it? Significant. You say, now we know that what's in the textbooks isn't really the real stuff. But we know it, but you see, we know evolution is true. And this explanation is just as good as any until we can come up with a better one. Which, of course, is on the basis of this kind of stuff, thousands and thousands of school children have been inadvertently, perhaps, and college students challenged to throw away their Christian faith. Now, by the way, I'll say one more thing and I'll quit. Dr. Jansen is a very fine gentleman, a very honest man. I said to him one day, I said, Dr. Jansen, I asked you a question. I said, is evolution, general evolution, mega evolution, honestly now, is it a faith or is it a science? Well, he said, he thought for a minute, he said, well, there's really no question about it. He said, it's a faith. Faith. It's a science. Listen to me. Now, not that he wouldn't use the word science, but when the God, the people at the top, those who are really doing the work, those from whom the ideas are coming, when they say evolution is a science, they're not telling us that they're using science in a way that they don't use it in the laboratory. They're giving it a special meaning. It is not scientific in the sense that we think of science. Well, we'll stop there. As I said, we'll pick this up tomorrow and talk about the latest developments, what's happened since neo-Darwinism, and then go into some of the more specialized arguments. Are there any questions? It's 9. I don't want to worry. It's 8:20. Let's go till at least 8:30. We'll stop now for no questions. Yes. Tentatively, I think the flood was around 10 to 12,000 BC myself, tentatively. We're going to talk more about the problems of geology and working this out. I would say, but I wouldn't. Well, just tentatively. Well, every question is an intellectual question because we deal with it with our minds. But it's also a moral question. You see, you're right. Creationism is not a science. Not in the strict sense of that word, science. simply because of the nature of it. It cannot be, because it cannot be experimentally reproduced. And it cannot be falsified in the experimentally. Therefore, it's not a science. And I don't mind anybody saying that. But what gets me is to say that evolution is a science in that sense, because it cannot be experimentally reproduced, never has been. And the way they got it constructed is not subject to falsification. We'll talk about that later. But the question, in other words, both of them are worldviews that are based upon probabilities. You can't go in the laboratory and do either one of them. That's the general approach you have to take. Yes. Well, my answer is I don't know. I do not know. I would say this, that the Bible doesn't say. That's one reason I don't know. Yeah. It doesn't say when the beginning was. Second thing is that you understand that the scientific views, what we call scientific views of time and space, are also mathematical models that are changing rapidly. Well, I just don't know. The Genesis makes room for, he says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. It doesn't say that. Could have. But I just don't know. I don't think it's really pertinent. I don't think really it's critical one way or the other. The question is not when, but the question is how. Any other questions? That's a good question. I didn't mean to go over it. I just don't know. And that's really not my field. I don't know much about that area. Any other questions? Well, thank you for your attention tonight. You've been very kind. You've worked hard with me. I really appreciate it. All right.
I'm trying to remember... Maybe you recall the joke that made it.